And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Many of you know that I spent last week at the Take Back America conference right here in Washington, D.C. And when I was there, I was able to interview a large number of various progressive voices. Some of you heard me last week interviewing them live with Guy James at my side. Well, I'm back here in the studio, but there were many interviews that I did that I couldn't do live, that I did at various times when I'm not here on the horn. And I want to share them with you. Tomorrow, in fact, I'm going to go over our many members of Congress that I interview. But today I want to talk to a host of different progressives, if you will. And, first we start with Carl Pope. He's the executive director of the Sierra Club, and he'll talk, of course, about environmental issues. Then I interview John Arnsmeyer. Now, he's the founder and the CEO of the Small Business Majority. Many people think that business should inherently be for the Republicans. John Arnsmeyer makes a strong case that actually business should support the Democrats, progressive principles. I move on to author Christine Pelosi, the daughter of Nancy Pelosi, who is telling everyone how to run for office. And then finally, what I think was the best interview, really the whole time I was there, my favorite one, just for reminiscing, just for the man, because I respect him so much, my interview with television talk show host Phil Donahue. So stick around, buckle your seatbelt. There's a lot of very interesting things talking about this hour. Carl Pope, John Arnsmeyer, Christine Pelosi, and then Phil Donahue. Let's start with the executive director of the Sierra Club, Carl Pope.
I'm sitting here now with Carl Pope. He is executive director of the Sierra Club. Carl Pope, welcome to the Inside
Scoop. It's great to be with you.
Now, the Sierra Club has been around for
117 years.
117 years. Is it the oldest environmental organization?
We and the Audubon Society are equally old, both founded in the same year.
Now, of course, times have changed a lot in 117 years. We hear a lot that this administration is anti-environment, that they're not doing good for the environment, but a lot of people just sort of know that in the back of their minds. They might know about global warming, for example, but what specifically has this administration done or is doing to harm the environment?
Well, to give you a couple of concrete examples, this administration has actually stripped environmental protections from 10% of America's land surface. 10% of this country that had environmental protections when they came into power no longer do.
Give me some examples. What does that mean?
For example, in Appalachia, there were 4,000 miles of streams that were designated as streams. You and I look at them, they look like streams. They had Clean Water Act protection in 2000. They no longer have Clean Water Act protection because the administration has said, nope, these are not really part of the waters of the United States, because they want coal companies to be able to do mountaintop removal and fill those rivers and streams with rubble.
No, wait just a second. I mean, mountain streams are, when I think of clean, pure water, I mean, I live here next to the Potomac River. That's one of the dirtiest rivers in the United States. But I think that way where it begins in West Virginia, at least there, it's clean. Are you talking about how can they designate mountain streams as not being part of the waterways of the United States?
They passed a regulation, and then the regulation was thrown out, but they just told the EPA act as if the regulation was in place. They simply don't obey the law.
Back up here. The Clean Water Act specifically does what?
The Clean Water Act specifically says that before you put any pollution into the waters of the United States, you have to have a permit, and that permit comes with a lot of requirements. What the administration did was to say that what are called headwater streams, the places where all of our clean water originates, are not waters of the United States if you can't navigate them.
Are they the waters of Canada, Mexico? What are they talking about?
I don't know. They're not waters, I guess, because you can't navigate them. They said if you can't navigate it, it's not a waterway.
Now, is navigable in the Clean Water Act?
No.
Well, you know, water is water is water. So the Bush administration had a regulation that basically said water is not water.
That is correct.
That we don't have to regulate. I don't know why navigation would matter at all. This isn't about traveling on the water. It's about keeping it clean.
That's correct.
Okay, so he said if you can't navigate on these streams, which are the cleanest probably water in the United States, they're not waters of the United States.
That's correct.
This was an executive order. Was this published and everything?
No, this was a regulation which they tried to publish, and then they didn't publish. They
this
never
is the
finalized
EPA did this regulation.
And the Corps of Engineers. And they then said, even though we don't have a final regulation in place, act as if it was in place, don't require these people to have a permit. So what happens is, We actually, for the first time, we've been filing lawsuits in the Sierra Club for about 30 years. Last week, for the first time in our history as an organization, I signed a blanket authorization for our lawyers to enter a lawsuit against any mountaintop removal operation in the state of Kentucky, because these operations are happening so fast that we don't have time to go through our normal legal approval process. I told our lawyers, you have a blank check. I've never given our lawyers a blank check. But there is so much lawlessness.
Explain to me here. So the EPA, this wasn't under Christine Todd Whitman, was it? I assume it was after she left. I mean, or maybe it was.
It started under her, but it wasn't her doing. It was the White House's doing. It was Dick Cheney's doing.
Okay, so then they have this regulation to say, in effect, that waters are not waters. And then they basically tell coal companies, take what you will.
That's correct.
But they're still breaking the law. So if you sue them, they should still be liable no matter what the president says, right?
The problem is that if you they're required to have a permit, but if EPA and the Corps of Engineers said you don't have a permit, then the company's not liable because the government told them it was okay to go ahead.
But how does the government have a right to sanction illegal behavior?
That has been, of course, one of the major issues with this administration.
You sued, right, several years back when this happened?
We sued, and this case is still making its way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
How have you done so far?
Well, we got a good ruling from a federal appeals court judge. We don't know whether we'll get a good ruling from the Supreme Court, but we haven't gotten there yet. The main thing is, while this lawsuit's going on, all of these mountain streams are being lost.
Okay, can you get a preliminary injunction? I'm a lawyer, by the way, so I know the legal terms. Can you get a preliminary injunction saying, look, these streams will be irreparably harmed? They're being filled in. They're being caved in with rubble. It's irreparable harm.
We can do that on every permit. Every time if a particular coal company wants to fill a particular stream, and if we know about it in time, but of course they don't have to apply for a permit, so we don't necessarily know about it.
How about a blanket injunction?
We have not been able to get a blanket injunction.
You've tried, I'm sure.
Yes, there was one federal court judge at the district court level who issued a blanket injunction, and the circuit court sided with the polluters and took it away. So we are now forced to try to catch these guys as they get ready to start the bulldozers, to run into federal court, and to get an injunction against each one of these operations.
Now, these lands, are these federal lands? Are these company-owned lands?
No, these are private lands. No, in some cases, they're federal lands, some cases they're private lands, but they're still waters of the United States. You aren't allowed to destroy a creek on your property. Creeks are protected, whoever's property they're on.
Now, you're talking about mountaintop removal. I mean, you're talking about wholesale. There used to be a mountain there, and it's gone.
It's gone. That's right. And in many cases, it's gone for an amount of coal that is so trivial that if you'd put a windmill on top of the mountain, you would have generated more electricity than you do by cutting the mountain down and...
So why don't they do that? All right, these are businessmen. I understand they don't give a damn about the environment. They don't care about water. All right, but in terms of sheer capitalism, if you can make more energy with a windmill than with removing a mountain, why don't they do it?
You can get the money faster if you burn the coal. The windmill produces wind for decades, hundreds of years. They can burn the coal really fast. This is all about the present versus the future. This administration has an ideology which says, let the future take care of itself. If you look at everything they do, and frankly, that's true about the way they invaded Iraq. It was, we'll invade Iraq, and then we'll worry about what happens after
this. It's true about the warrantless wiretapping. Right. We'll spy on everybody first, and then later we'll try to get retroactive immunity for it.
It's all about the present. They don't believe in the future.
Okay, so you talked about a Clean Water Act. That's an example. How about the airs? Is our air more polluted than it used to be?
The air is more polluted than it used to be, and the administrator of EPA just last week, issued new regulations, which he was required to issue, and simply said, well, I know the law says I have to issue an air quality standard to protect forests and other places that are damaged by ozone. I know that my scientists have told me that the present standard doesn't do what the law says, and I, in fact, know that I have told courts, the federal courts, that I was going to clean up this pollution. The White House told me not to clean up the pollution. I work for the White House, not the people of the United States. I'm going to do what the White House says.
You're talking about the companies are saying this? Or
no, Steve Johnson, the administrator of EPA. It is time for Steve Johnson to resign.
We don't even know his name. The interesting thing is that Christine Todd Whitman, and she did a lot of things wrong.
But she did some things right.
Right, she did. But we can talk about September 11th and not warning people about the danger there. But she was seen as a more moderate Republican, and she, since she was an ex-governor of New Jersey, people knew her, they knew her name, and they could focus their attentions on her, people don't even know who's running the EPA now. I mean, Steve Johnson is not a household name.
No, he is not a household name, and he has decided that he took an oath of office to uphold the laws of the United States, and he has decided that that oath of office means to do what the president tells him. He is completely a flunky for the White House.
Now, is he... well, what's his background?
He's a career scientist. It's quite amazing. He wasn't controversial because he was just a career scientist.
But he understands that his job depends on pleasing the administration.
And he apparently believes that's the way to do his job. He signs orders he doesn't believe in. He signs regulations he knows and believes are illegal. He doesn't do what the courts tell him. He just says, I do what the White House says.
Okay, but it's been a year since you've had a Democratic Congress. Have they conducted appropriate oversight of these issues?
Yes, they have done 10 times as much oversight in the last 2 years as was done in the previous 8 years. Johnson has been up there repeatedly. They've subpoenaed him there. I suspect he will face contempt of Congress.
Who's the hero in this?
Oh, there are a lot of heroes. Henry Waxman, the head of the
Investigation
Committee.
He's always my hero. just about everything.
Senator Boxer, my senator from California. Congressman Markey from Massachusetts. Congressman Ray Hall from West Virginia.
Is that what they're going to have to do, hold him in contempt? Is that the only way that really you're going to have any control over EPA?
I think they may have to impeach them.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you think there's a chance of it? I mean, a few months left before...
It's only a few months left, but I think we got to start the process. We got to send a very powerful signal that the law is the law. This is still a nation of laws, not a nation of Dick Cheney.
You know, I'll tell you, a lot of people say, well, the issue of the Supreme Court is never a big issue for people, and yet your fight is in the courts. You need federal judges that respect the law rather than respect a conservative agenda.
And we've been very fortunate. We still have a lot of them. We have actually done very well with judges appointed by Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., even judges appointed by this president have looked at what this administration does and said, wait a minute, you can't do that.
Because it's just that lawless.
It's that lawless. The Supreme Court, 5-4, ruled that the way they were handling the global warming problem was illegal and that Steve Johnson had to act. Mr. Johnson, when asked under oath, how many employees in your office are working on this Supreme Court order, said, I don't know.
In other words,
we have a
none
lot of
yet.
Things to do.
Now, let me just ask you this. You're talking about mountaintop removal. It is against the law. It's lawless. I get that. How does it affect you and me and the people who drink water? I mean, can't we just get water elsewhere? What does this do to the environment?
What it means is, for example, when the rain falls on these spoils from these coal mines, it becomes acidic and no longer fit to drink. It kills the fish.
That goes all the way down, right?
All the way down.
Like I said, I live near the Potomac. So eventually that would all probably come to
the water quality in the Potomac will be impacted in a major, major way. And when you destroy those headwater streams, you also don't have a place to store water when the rains fall. And so when you have a dry period, the drought is much worse. Look at what's happening in the southeast. Look at the plight of people in Atlanta. If we don't take care of the headwater streams, the droughts we're having in the southeast are going to be just every year occurrences.
The other thing about coal is I've heard some people talk about clean coal technology. I see that all over. They got lots of commercials, the coal companies. Is there really such a thing as clean coal technology, or is coal still pretty dirty?
Well, you could burn coal in a clean way, and you would have electricity that would cost you $1 a kilowatt hour. There's no such thing as affordable clean coal. Coal is a very dirty way. You can clean it up, but the cost of cleaning it up makes the electricity it generates unaffordable. Remember something about both coal and nuclear. What they do in a coal-fired power plant or a nuclear power plant is they boil water. That's all they do. Any child with a magnifying glass in the sun can boil water. So
that's not dirty at all.
That's right. So it's really
interesting.
Yes, you could make nuclear safe, and yes, you could make coal clean, but you wouldn't want to pay the price. Why not do it right in the first place?
So when the companies say they have clean coal technology, they just mean slightly cleaner than before. It's still
that's
pretty
what
dirty.
They really mean when they talk about clean coal, being slightly cleaner than before.
So you advocate, I presume, solar, wind energy, hydroelectric power. Where should we get our energy, let's say, 20, 30, 40 years ago when we're no longer dependent on oil?
Well, the first thing we should do is, right now, whatever your utility bill is, 80% of it goes to heat and cool the great outdoors. You don't want to heat and cool the great outdoors. You want to heat and cool your living room. 90% of what you use to power your light bulbs goes to create heat, not light. In the summer in particular, you don't want your light bulbs to be hot. You just want light to read your book.
Right.
We need to have high-performance, low-carbon buildings and electricity and tools so that you aren't wasting most of the money you spend on your utility bill heating and cooling the great outdoors. And if
now, tell me this. When you say heating and cooling the great outdoors, you mean that when my air conditioner puts hot air outside and cold air inside? Or how could you talk about a heat pump? What do you mean?
Well, when you do that and you have a leaky window or a leaky attic, the cold air goes out.
Okay.
And in
so
the winter,
more insulation. Is
it's not just, it's a whole matter of building high-performance buildings. We now know how to build buildings that won't have utility bills. How would you like not to have...
How can you have a building without a utility bill?
It's very simple. You can generate enough electricity on site with solar panels to meet your actual needs to power your stuff.
Everything.
Everything. If your building was a high-performance building, if you had the latest appliances with the best engines, if you had...
Could it run my air conditioner, too?
It can run your air conditioner if you have an efficient air conditioner. In fact, you can get a lot of your air conditioning by putting a coil of air down underneath your house. And in the...
Sure, it's colder underneath
the ground. It's colder underneath your house, and in the winter it's warmer. And that's free heat and free cooling. You don't have to... All you have to do is move the air. That doesn't take much electricity. Run a little fan.
You know, what's very interesting to me is that people are starting to get environmental concerns. I have Republicans, conservatives, I have evangelical Christians who write on my blog, call into my show, and we can disagree on a million issues, but they want to protect the environment. How is it that, I mean, this seems to be an issue that is completely a win for the Democrats. Unless you are in the business of polluting, I don't know anyone that supports these polluters.
That is correct. The problem is those who are in the business of polluting are also in the business of writing campaign checks.
Right.
And so the past is going to fight the future tooth and nail. They're going to fight dirty. They're not going to fight clean. They understand that coal and oil are not competitive in the 21st century. They understand that their business model is a 20th century business model that's going to go away. They want to go away as slowly as possible, and they don't care how much damage they do to the rest of us holding on to their profits.
Lastly, the energy bill that this administration passed a few years back, it gives subsidies to coal and oil. What exactly does it do to help us... Not help us in the future and make us go to the past.
It gave huge subsidies to the coal and oil companies, and it removed many of the regulations they previously had to comply with. It's very interesting. Senator McCain voted against that bill because back in 2005 he said, rightly, this is a very bad bill. It's unwarranted subsidies for the richest corporations in the world. We don't need to do this. We shouldn't be doing this. Unfortunately, you want to see the power of the past. Senator McCain now wants to be seen as a member in good standing of the Bush wing of the Republican Party. He now says we should keep those subsidies in place. He has refused to vote against
them. Interesting. So he's flip-flopped on this.
He has flip-flopped on
this. He voted against it, but now he says it's a good thing.
And now he says it's a good thing.
Very interesting. Now, how much of this do you think started because of the Secret Energy Commission of Dick Cheney behind closed doors? And
oh, the bill was written by that Energy Commission.
And we still don't even know who was on it. I mean, we know
we know who was on it. What we don't know is who promised what to whom.
Ah, what was the quid pro quo?
We don't know the quid pro quos. We know who was on it, and we know what they asked for, but we don't know what they got in return.
And the people who were on it were the heads of coal companies and oil companies.
And the heads of oil companies and the heads of the nuclear firms, people... Yeah.
So, a Democrat becomes president, hopefully, in January 20th, 2009. How will all this change?
That's up to us. If we make the next 10 months about demanding an energy revolution in this country, we can get one. If we allow ourselves to just vote against instead of voting for, if we allow candidates to triangulate, if we allow candidates to offer us low-bar solutions, we will not get the energy future we need and deserve, because then the oil and the coal and the nuclear folks will still have their hands on the levers of power. We need to get their hands off the levers of power, not only by winning, but by winning big, and by winning big with a big message, we want change.
And you've got your hands full, but you're definitely on the side of light and peace and clean air and water, Carl Pohl.
Mark, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much
for coming on the Inside Scoop.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. I know I did. It's always a pleasure to talk with one of the good guys. And here's another good guy, and maybe not from a corner that you'd think. You know, of course, that people who support the environment support Democrats, support progressive causes. That's easy. But you might be surprised to hear a businessman tell you the reasons, at least a small businessman, telling you why the Democratic Party progressive principles help him as well. Here's my interview with John Arnsmeyer, the founder and CEO of the Small Business Majority.
I'm talking now with John Arnsmeyer. He's the founder and CEO of the Small Business Majority. John, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Glad to be here, Mark.
You were telling me that you don't think the Chamber of Commerce and a lot of conservative groups represent small business well.
They don't. If you look at the list of issues that small businesses are most concerned about, I mean, first of all, heading the list is health care reform, tax reform for taxes that really affect them, access to capital, energy, a whole host of other issues. These are not issues that the Chamber of Commerce tends to lobby in support of. I mean, healthcare reform is absolutely critical to the health of small business in this country. And the fact that it's such an impediment to people going out and starting businesses, as well as growing businesses, is actually an impediment to the American dream. And yet, the Chamber of Commerce and other National Federation of Independent Business traditionally oppose any kind of comprehensive health reform, which just keeps small business in the dark ages.
Now, help me understand this. How much of a small business's cost is health care? 10%, 15%? I mean,
it's often at least 10, 15%, and it's growing. It's growing by twice the rate of inflation.
If we had universal health care or even a single-payer system, how would that help small business?
Well, first of all, the overall cost would come down. All the comprehensive proposals out there are accompanied by significant cost containment measures. Also, by eliminating a lot of the waste and the administrative costs in the system, the cost would come down. But more importantly, the issue of getting health care and the issue of being concerned about that when you leave a big business to start a small business, that would go away. And that's the biggest issue, is the uncertainty of not knowing whether, not only whether the entrepreneur can provide health care for his or her employees, but whether he or she can get it for their own family. And it creates a terrible impediment in the system, and that would go away with most of the comprehensive health care reform proposals that are out there.
So you could concentrate on your business rather than what health care plan.
Right. Most people, I mean, I ran my business, you know, I wanted to focus on my business. I didn't want to focus on health care, which I had no expertise in, and there's no reason why most small business people should be worrying about health care.
Okay, you also mentioned taxes. Now, the Chamber of Commerce, the right wing, they will tell you they are saving businessmen taxes. Are they right?
Well, the taxes that they focus on are taxes for the very wealthy and the estate tax, which have virtually no impact on small businesses. The average small business person makes $75,000 a year. Is only 2% of people who earn most of their money through small business are in the top tax bracket. Less than 1% would be affected by the estate tax with the type of exemptions that are currently being proposed on both sides of the aisle. So,
how about corporate taxes?
Corporate taxes, for the most part, don't affect small businesses because they are either they're either sole proprietors and don't pay it, or they are organized as pass-through as S-corporations. I'll tell you, the tax that does kill small business is the payroll tax. One way or the other, whether a sole proprietor is paying it for him or herself or is having to cover it for employees, that's 15.3% tax, and it's a regressive tax. So if you want to look at taxes that affect small business, it's not traditionally what the Chamber and the National Federation of Independent Business focus on.
Right, and that's a tax that actually hurts people who are making less than a certain amount more than people who are making more than a certain
Absolutely.
Amount.
Absolutely. And it even goes so far that if you are not incorporated, your health care costs aren't tax deductible, because even though you can get a tax deduction for on the federal income tax, you have to earn the money and pay the FICA tax on it before you can take the deduction if you're not organized as a corporation. So in fact, all across the board, the tax system is stacked against small business, and the proposals that the Chamber and others put out there don't do much to change that.
You mentioned capital. Small businesses need capital. Is there a way that progressives make it easier for small businesses to get capital than conservatives?
Well, small businesses are getting killed for capital, and it's now worse with the credit crunch. And again, large businesses have access to credit. Small businesses do not. The Bush administration has attempted to cut the Small Business Administration, the SBA budget, by over half during most of the last 7 years. Some of those cuts have been restored by Congress.
What does that matter? Where does that money actually go? The small business.
That money goes to guarantee loans for small businesses. And again, I don't want to overstate the importance of the SBA, because most small businesses don't rely on the SBA. Most small businesses rely, quite frankly, on credit cards. They rely on home equity loans, which, of course, are now pretty impossible to get. And what we've proposed is a small business credit corporation that would operate much like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that would be guaranteed by the government, that would be ultimately securitized, and you could sell securities. And if you get enough volume, you can rate these loans so that no one's taking a risk. Right now, banks look at small businesses, and if they're not collateralizing their personal assets, they look only at the individual small business and say, oh, that's too big a risk. But if you spread this out over many, many small businesses and you score it properly and you set the interest rate properly, it's not a problem.
I got to play devil's advocate with you. I mean, talking about scoring it properly, how do we know this isn't going to end up into be another subprime crisis where you have a lot of shaky businesses and it's securitized and all the securities?
Well, you need to do the due diligence on the business. And this is what we would argue. Right now, banks don't really care about your business. They care about your home that they can secure, or they care about your other personal assets. We're saying, let's look at the business. We're not saying that businesses shouldn't be rated based on the value of their business. We believe they should be. Loans should be given out. It shouldn't be just given out willy-nilly. Obviously, businesses that don't have a secure business plan, that can't convince banks that they're solid, they shouldn't get loans.
Now, you mentioned energy. How does energy affect? What is your business, by the way? I never.
Well, I'm now doing this full time. So, but my business was an e-commerce internet services company, and our business was not particularly affected by energy costs, but many businesses are affected by energy costs, which are, of course, soaring. And again, most of the efforts that are now underway to make businesses more green are focused on the large business sector. And we're saying that 50% of the commercial energy is consumed by small businesses. Let's focus on government incenting small businesses to save energy. And there are a number of different programs out there that can do this.
Now, you're the founder and CEO of Small Business Majorities. This is a group of small businesses that are getting together to advocate for the policies that you're talking about. Now, my question is, why are you in the minority? I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but the perception is that businessmen, even small businessmen, generally vote more Republican, generally vote more with the conservatives. First of all, do you agree with that assessment? And if so, why? Why don't they get what you get?
Well, I would agree it's slightly more than the general public. But the interesting thing is the national research that we have done showed that there are 23% who vote Democrat, who consider themselves Democrat, 30% who consider themselves Republicans, and 41% who consider themselves independent. So you're talking about a group that is slightly more Republican, but much more independent. Most of the polling that we've seen showed in recent presidential elections, they went about 55-45 for the Republicans. So it is a little bit more than the general public, but not substantially more. And why? Because we haven't done a good enough job as progressives to organize small businesses.
Well, let me ask you this. Senator Obama or Senator Clinton, either one, the nominee of the Democratic Party, comes to you and says, John, you know about small business. What can I do? What commercials can I do? What can I put in my speeches? What can I put in my ads? What can I do to help encourage people like yourself to come vote for me?
Well, the first is comprehensive health care reform. And the polling that we've done shows that small business owners do want comprehensive health care reform, and they're open to a variety of different proposals, including ones where there would be an obligation to pay a certain amount into a pool or provide health insurance.
Okay, but Clinton and Obama still have the employer model, right? I mean, it's not a full single-payer plan.
Correct. And we want to see comprehensive reform, and we are not advocating for single-payer or shared responsibility. We're saying it can go either way. To be honest with you, the more likely political scenario in states and at the national level is not single-payer. It is a kind of shared responsibility model along the lines of the Clinton and Obama plans.
But at the end of the day, you as an employer would rather not worry about it, right? I mean, you would rather see some single-payer plan simply because it's no headache for you. It's not your responsibility. You can focus on your business.
There is a strong case that can be made that is better for small business. In the polling that we have done, it doesn't poll quite as well as various shared responsibility models.
Really?
But
among small businessmen?
In the most recent poll we did, it was about 50, it was 42 in favor, 40 against, single payer, and the rest neutral, whereas the shared responsibility was like 47-31.
Well, now explain that to me, because I would think, if I were a businessman, I would rather just not worry about it. I don't have the cost. I don't have to worry about whether I have a sick employee or a well employee.
Well, this gets to the whole issue surrounding single payer and surrounding health care reform in general, and there's fear of shifting too far away from the existing system. And again, a lot of the polling we've done, the polling that the Herndon Alliance has done, shows that people, and that includes small business owners, are worried about moving away from the existing system. Now, you and I can agree that in theory, and I wouldn't disagree with you, and there is some small business support for this, that making it so small business doesn't have to think about health insurance makes a lot of sense. I'm just telling you two things.
So people fear change.
People fear change. We are not... We are open, and if single payer becomes the most prominent healthcare reform effort, we are there. We will be there. But to be honest with you, you know, we're based in California. We're heavily involved in the healthcare debate there. We're working in other states. Pretty much in no state, and certainly at the national level, is the prospect for single payer as good as for some kind of shared responsibility model. And we don't want to not focus on that if we can get comprehensive reform that way.
Do the Clinton-Obama shared responsibility models take us further down the road toward a single payer?
Much further down the road. They are radical changes. They don't throw out the existing employer-based model, and that's largely because when you look at the polling around the country, people don't want to give that up. 95% of, although 85% of people have insurance and 15% don't, 95% of all voters have insurance. So there
interesting, 95% of all voters.
The uninsured don't vote, basically. So
that's a whole other issue.
Unlike the right, we are not ideologically locked in to single payer versus no single payer. We want comprehensive reform that is going to make affordable access for everybody, non-discrimination based on health, and reduce costs overall.
So help me back again with the first question I asked you. You get $100,000, I don't know, $500,000, I don't know what an ad costs these days. You get to design an ad for the nominee of the Democratic Party. And you say, Senator, this is the ad that I think will change people's minds of people like myself, people who have run small businesses. What would be in that ad?
Well, first of all, let me start before I tell you what the ad would be, is that both Clinton and Obama have obviously much better health care proposals vis-a-vis comprehensive insurance. They do have proposals for funding innovation in business, for funding the sorts of innovation that small business is at the forefront of. They do have proposals for increasing capital to certain segments of the small business population. So they already have the pieces in place. And you ask a very interesting question, because they have not done a good job of packaging
people
it.
People don't know that.
Right. Well,
I haven't heard
we
about
are
their
trying
capital
to change
plans.
That. We are trying to change that. If you go to their website, all the pieces are there, but neither one has a section that says small business. You're talking about half of the private sector workforce. You're talking about basically half
so
of the
at
economy.
At the very least, on their website,
they are not doing a great job of selling what they're already proposing. So we are, in fact, trying to change that.
Terrific.
And so what the ad would be, you lead with health care. You lead with health care and you talk about the need for comprehensive reform and how that's going to alleviate the stress and concern about being able to run a business, start a business, and worry about health care. You then move on to access to capital, talk about the proposals they have. You talk about funding innovative businesses, green businesses, and others. You know, most of the innovation
it's
takes
place. It's 3 a.m. in your business. You're worrying about health care. You can't sleep. Who's going to pick up the phone? Now, ads, the problem, let's face it, a lot of what you say is important to you because that's what you do, but you know, you start talking about raising capital and people's eyes glaze over. Well, you know, what's, you know, maybe we need another ad campaign, but sort of the sexy way, we show a guy running a business
I will tell you exactly how you do it. The current policies of the Bush administration and the proposals the Republicans are making do not further the American dream. They further the interests of a select, and again, you don't make this ad to with Marxist overtones.
Right,
about preserving what's great about American entrepreneurism and the American dream and American business, and that is that anybody can go in, roll up their sleeves, start a business as unimpeded as possible. And you talk about how the policies that have been put forth in the name of small business don't really have any benefit for the average person who gets up every morning, tries to run their own either sole proprietorship or small business, tries to make payroll every 2 weeks. And you talk in those terms, you talk about how healthcare reform would change that. You talk about how more openness to capital would change it. You talk about how incentives to cut energy costs would change that. And you focus on the change that will enable that small business owner to do a better job running their business, which is something they love, helping their employees, helping make the jobs more competitive for their employees. Right now, with healthcare and other things, it's more big businesses have a competitive advantage to hiring employees.
Because
you have to sort of take a leap. You have to really want to work at a small business to give up secure healthcare, to give up easily managed 401k plan, and small businesses struggle to have affordable healthcare, to have 401k plans. They struggle with costs. The average costs on small businesses are greater per employee than on big businesses. So you talk about ways that you're going to change that. And you take a lot of the proposals that Clinton and Obama already have and you put them in a frame of supporting and preserving small business. They haven't done a good job of that. I got to say, the Republicans...
Like I said, we need that. We need to say, yeah. I'm running a business here,
right.
And I don't want to worry about my employees getting sick. I just
right.
want a health care plan. I don't want to worry about gasoline prices going up. The Democrats proposed this. What have the Republicans done? I'm voting Democrat this time.
Right. Well, we need to do a much better job. I'd be the first to say that the Democrats have been AWOL in terms of reaching out to small business. That's one of the reasons that we exist. I mean, we're not exclusively a Democratic organization, but obviously the sorts of policies that we're putting forth are more likely at the moment to be supported by Democrats, although that's not entirely true. We had a Republican governor in California with a very innovative health care plan. The Democrats have been AWOL, have ignored this constituency group. By the way, there are more sole proprietors in this country than there are private sector union members. So
wow, that's
interesting. 9% of the private sector workforce is running as our sole proprietors. It's less than 8% private sector workforce.
Very interesting, John Archmeyer. Thank you for coming on.
Okay, Mark, good to be here.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
I hope you enjoyed John Archmeyer. My next guest was the author Christine Pelosi, the daughter of Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
To the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you are another of the Pelosi children. We've heard a lot about Alexandra, had heard documentaries, but now you have your own effort, Campaign Boot Camp.
That's right. I wrote a book called Campaign Boot Camp for the volunteers and the candidates out there who are trying to get involved in public service and make a difference for their communities.
Now, I mean, do you learn this stuff from your mother? I mean, your mother, her father was mayor, I think, of Baltimore, right? And then she went to politics. Is politics becoming sort of a family affair? Do you learn at the feet of your mom how to do things?
Well, I did. It was because I started when I was very, very young. It was 1968. I was a little baby in a stroller, and my mom had a scarf with all these H's on it for Hubert H. Humphrey, and that's about as much as I remember, leafletting our apartment building in New York City where we lived at the time. But it happens every year. First you go out in October and you leaflet, and then you go back at the end of the month and you trick-or-treat. So the first informal polling of your neighborhood comes with the kind of chocolate you get from your neighbors.
I see. If they don't like your candidate, you don't get a lot of good candy.
No, and if they do, you get a lot of extra chocolate, so that's always nice.
So here's your campaign boot camp. You have your strategy right here. Identify your call to service, know your community, build your leadership teams, define your message, connect with people, raise the money, mobilize to win.
That's right. Last cycle, 2 years ago now, in 2006, I worked on something called the AFSCME People Newhouse PAC Congressional Candidates Boot Camp.
Okay.
Where AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, Public Service Employees Union, worked to put on boot camps for people running for Congress. And we worked with over 40 challengers, 12 of whom are now members of Congress. And their stories are in the book, as well as interviews that I did with Democrats, Republicans, and Independents on the best ways to campaign and serve your country.
Now, do you take people who've already won primary campaigns or even people into primary campaigns?
Well, now with the book, I'm going out around the country, so I'm doing boot camps for nonprofits, for community organizations, for people who are running for office at all levels of service. And
just any candidate you believe in?
Well, in doing the boot camps, people come to people come to the workshops, and they're open to everybody. So, for example, I'll do a
Republican
workshop. Well, I did the Bipartisan Indo-American Council in Milpitas, California, for example, and you had Indo-Americans, Republicans and Democrats, who were talking about, well, how do you run for office? How do you get
how
involved
How do you
in
run for
service?
Office? My God, it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you have to, I don't know, pretend to be nice to all these people you don't like. It doesn't sound
well,
very
now,
pleasant.
First, you have to like people. And in chapter one, at the end of each chapter, we have exercises. Uh-huh. So at the end of identifying your call to service, I have the public service fitness test. And one of the questions is, do you want to do something or do you want to be something? Do you want to be the person that gets to go on the radio and have the fancy title and have the attention? Or do you want to do something for other human beings? And the way I test a call to service is, what would you be willing to give your time, your money, your reputation, and work your heart out for, even if you don't get any credit, even if you lose? If you're still willing to put yourself out there, then that's your call to service. And then if you are willing to do that, and people trust that you will hold the public's interest above your own personal interest, then I think that's how you connect with people and start to build a reputation in the community as somebody who could run for office or serve on the board of a nonprofit or be a spokesperson for somebody running for office.
But isn't it hard, particularly for young people today, when there's so many vested interests, whether it be the Democratic Party or anywhere else, there are people that have been doing this for 20, 30 years. It's their turn. They're next in line. I guess Barack Obama has shown that you don't have to be next in line. But generally, isn't it hard to break out of that mold and say, well, hey, I don't want to wait my turn. I've got some really good ideas that you should help me with.
Well, ultimately, politics is all about people. And if you can survive the four metrics, management, message, money, and mobilization, if you can promote excellence in those four areas of campaigning, then you can make a case for yourself as a candidate. We talk a little bit in the book about Chris Murphy, who's a very young member of Congress now. He's like 33 years old, and he was running against Nancy Johnson, this entrenched incumbent in Connecticut. And he ran the right way. You know, everybody runs when they're young. They say it's youth versus experience. Well, somebody ran the wrong way. He goes nameless in the book because he said his older opponent was too old for the job.
Uh-huh.
So
all the seniors didn't vote
said,
for him.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And showed him the power of so-called old women, as one of them told me.
Right.
And Chris Murphy did it right. He just said she has been there so long that she is out of touch on the war and on Medicaid and on privatizing Social Security. And it's time for a better way, which is peace in the Middle East and health care that works for everyone and protecting Social Security. So I think that the answer is, if you believe in the wisdom of crowds and you're willing to go out and talk with people, organize them in a disciplined way, you can win even as a young person. The key is to show that you're willing to listen to everybody and build coalitions. When I ran for DNC the first time, I was 30 years old. I was the youngest person running. I'm running now, and
but you did have a last name that helped you.
I did, but I had to go out and prove it. If anything, you have to work doubly hard when you have a brand name, because people are going to kick the tires that much harder, because they thought that, well, if my last name is Pelosi, I must expect that they were going to vote for me. So I actually had to work twice as hard to prove that, no, I was running on my own skills and my own service as a member of the platform committee of the Democratic Party. So
real quick,
and
I know you have to go. Let's say someone wants to run for DNC. That's a good place to start, I guess, into politics, right?
Absolutely. If you want to run for office, the key thing to do is buy campaign boot camp, perform the exercises, ask yourself, do I want to do something or do I want to be something? And then get your mentors and your friends and people that you've volunteered with to be your spokespeople to go out and help you put together a campaign.
Christine Pelosi, thank you for coming here on the Inside.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
And finally, my last interview of the hour, the one I really enjoyed the most. I think you'll be able to tell as you hear me interview Phil Donahue how much I enjoyed the interview. Here's a guy that's really famous but still never stopped being a nice guy. Here is Phil Donahue.
I am sitting here across from one of my heroes. I got to tell you. Now, you probably hear this all the time, but I am sitting here across from Phil Donahue. And, you know, you don't seem to get older. I mean, you look exactly the same. I'm just going to totally I don't usually gush, all right? I really don't. But I remember, God, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, watching your show, and I wanted to be a talk show host. I wanted to run down the aisle with my microphone. What do you think? It's amazing now. I guess Oprah has stolen your thunder, and then there have been many, many since then. But when you did it no one was doing it, right? I mean, you were the first.
Yeah,
go ahead, brag about yourself. Come on, come on. Do it.
Well, we were born in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
So celebrities were not available to us.
Right.
And we knew that if we had any chance of surviving at all, we had to rely on issues. So our first guest was Madeline Marie O'Hare, the atheist.
Okay.
Who got rid of prayer in public schools. Imagine.
Right.
Most hated woman in America.
Right.
There's no heaven, there's no hell. There's no God, there's no angels.
And she said that on your first show.
Uh-huh, and the building fell in.
I was just going to say, weren't you canceled the next day?
The entire city of Dayton came to a halt. People wouldn't leave the barbershop after they got the haircut. We entered screaming, as you might imagine. We had a management that held on against all the people.
How the heck did you get one of those in today's
age?
Well,
first of all, freedom's just another word for, we were so small. You know, if we had started on the network, we'd have died in the first week. But we were syndicated, and that's a more honest way. Every market that carried the Donahue Show made a decision to buy it. We weren't on a network. On a network, a vice president can end your career while he's shaving.
Right.
If I got canceled in Peoria, we were still on in Indianapolis.
Now, tell me this. Obviously, your political views are now well known. You are very much opposed to Iraq War. We're going to get to your documentary in just a second. Even when you were on MSNBC for however long that lasted, your views were well known. I, at least when I started watching you, and I was just a kid, but I don't think we knew your views. Do you think on your talk show you allowed your views to come through? Or
over the time, I did. I mean, we did over 6,000 hours. You can't walk down the center of every issue like a robotic tin man never revealing how you feel.
And you were running down the aisles. You were no robotic tin man.
I
love
that,
with the microphone in hand. I got to ask, did you ever trip?
Oh, sure.
sprint down those aisles.
In the early days, we didn't have wireless mics. In 1967.
Oh, my God.
I'm an analog guy in a digital world today.
Right.
I had a cord.
Uh-huh.
And I used to rush to the back row, because somebody had their
hand. Right, right, right. You would run. You'd sprint. That was part of your charm, actually.
And strangle three people in the front row. So when we finally got the wireless, then life became a little easier. But over the years, I guess I did lean. I began to lean. I always leaned left. I mean, I could,
Why is that? Are you from Dayton, Ohio? Where are you from?
I'm from Cleveland. I was born and raised in Cleveland.
All right. Kucinichville.
Uh-huh. In fact, I went to high school at St. Edward High School, which is in his district.
I am. Okay, I normally wouldn't call you on it. My other guests, I wouldn't. But here I am with the most professional guy in the entire industry, a guy that's been playing with microphones at least since 1967, and he's fiddling with this microphone, sitting on our stand, thinking
noise.
It's not going to cause. That's what you heard, my friends. Now, I don't call on my other guests who do this, but Phil Donahue should know better.
But these mics have wires.
I know. They're old-fashioned, aren't they?
You got to join the new world here, Mark. It's true. I just absentmindedly grab it, and that goes
I
apologize.
I play with things, too. Hey, tell me, you're from Cleveland. You say you've always leaned left. Is that your parents? Are they from a union family? Where does this come from?
I am. My father was a furniture salesman.
Okay. So was Barack Obama's grandfather. Do you know that?
No, really?
Yeah. His grandfather, the one from Kansas, was a furniture salesman.
I worked at Republic Steel in Canton, Ohio. And
you worked in a steel factory?
Uh-huh.
Did you do like assembly line stuff?
I was a mason's helper.
What does that mean?
That means I handed bricks to the guys who relined the open hearth furnaces. So
was that hot? I mean, did you burn your hands?
You'd be in for you could only go for 2 minutes and then you were out, or three, I forget.
Really?
But, your blue jeans would hurt when your blue jeans touched your skin. I mean, that's how hot it was in there.
Oh, my
God. Of course, it was dry. But, I don't want to overstate this. I mean, nobody came near death.
Well,
my
great-grandparents worked in the sweatshops, too.
Right.
Was the union stronger? When was this? I'm going to go to your age. 50, 60?
Summer of 1955.
Summer of
1954 or 5.
No, summer of 1954 or 5.
My junior and senior year at Notre Dame.
the idea, sort of as a historian, I wasn't around then, but the idea is that unions were a lot stronger
absolutely
in the 1950s
so
than today. That's true.
Oh, yes.
Okay, but here you are working where if you
by the way, we
team,
had a strike while I was there.
Did you really?
Yeah,
over
I
working
was on
conditions?
Strike.
Or?
I forget, I'm ashamed of myself. It must have been wages. I assume it was wages.
Don't play with that cord. I'm watching you.
I made 300 and I made, I think the pay was $3.50 an hour, which was big time.
That's a lot, yeah. I mean, our minimum wage today isn't much better.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the wage. I hope I'm right. Somebody's going to do the Google here and prove me wrong.
So the unions were there helping you with working conditions, with wages.
I was a member. You couldn't work there without being a member of the United Steelworkers of America, and I was.
Phil Donahue, what's happened to our unions? Be honest here.
Well, first of all, let me say, I've never crossed a picket line, and if you think I'm bragging, I am.
Good.
When the NBC technicians went on strike, we took our program to Stamford, Connecticut. I had the power then.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, the show was hot.
Right.
And I said, I'm not crossing this line.
Right.
And off we went to Stamford. Isn't it a shame? I mean,
is it because manufacturing has gone down? Is it harder to unionize
because,
the service industry?
It's because management has all the power and all the money.
Okay, but they had all the power 100 years ago in the progressive era when we started. What's the difference today?
They somehow, I think we've got people out there who so desperately need the job, they just don't have time for the organizer.
Didn't we have that in the 1950s? What was the difference?
I guess so.
Is it the immigrants coming across the border?
And the my parents lived through the 30s. I mean,
right,
remember
people
got their head beat over.
Sure, sure.
Sometimes by the cops.
Sure.
I mean, this was a brutal time. And all this pain and bloodshed that gave birth to this fabulous thing called the labor movement that put labor on the, gave them some clout at the bargaining table, has been largely wasted and dissipated over the years. This is, how about
we both recognize the problem. Tell me why do you think it is?
I think that management has successfully frightened workers into the belief that they won't have a job if they promote union organizing. And you're right, this isn't new. But I think it's more effective today. I also think as each year goes by, fewer and fewer young people appreciate the important role played by organized labor. It's just not a part of our public education.
Now, your father was in a union?
No, my father was a salesman, a retail furniture salesman.
That's right, a retail furniture salesman.
My uncle's my grandfather worked for the city transit in Cleveland.
It's just interesting. You're from Ohio. When I think of Ohio, I think of a longtime union culture
I
don't think of.
And it was. Cleveland was when I was a kid. Cleveland at Dayton, Ohio, at five Notre Dame, my alma mater, had five General Motors plants. Dayton, Ohio had five General Motors plants when I began my program in 1967, and they were all unionized.
Speaking of your alma mater, it's interesting to me that, your very first show, you had Atheist on the air.
Right.
And you probably were on the air at a time when, I don't know, Catholics were not sort of out as Catholic as much. I mean, it's hard to think today that that's the case because it's I think, a much... Did you get in trouble with your church or with people when you would promote, things like Atheists? Or?
Sure. We did our first pedophilia, and pedophilia show.
When?
86,
that's very early.
With my mother watching at her in her apartment in Cleveland.
Did your mother get mad at you?
She didn't say anything, but she had to be hurt,
because she so believed in that church.
Sure. I mean, my mother was a good Catholic girl from West Cleveland, and here's her son talking, the guy was from the New Orleans Times Picayune. His name is Jason Berry. He did the best work, early work on the. He said this is the church's Watergate.
Well, here's
and
my
nobody
question.
Believed him.
Why isn't it good? Why isn't it good as a Catholic to expose pedophilia?
Because we haven't been able to speak and to really criticize effectively this church. It has become a top-down, totally closed institution.
Hasn't it always been that way?
Yeah, but the stakes are larger now. The church is telling third world men that they shouldn't wear condoms in an age of AIDS.
Right.
That's a mortal sin. Stop this. And what have we heard really from the Pope? Has said he's against this war. Oh, well, thank you, Your Holiness. Let's have a little more force here. Let's say it more often.
Should
what
he excommunicate some of these people?
I see excommunication as a kind of medieval, anachronistic.
Okay. Speak out more strongly.
Right. And
should he say Rumsfeld has blood in his hands or something like that? I don't see the Pope saying things like
no,
that.
No, I don't. But he should be louder and more forceful. We still have a church deciding about who's a saint. I have evolved to a place where I'm with Tennyson.
Alfred Lord Tennyson.
There lives more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds.
I love that.
Isn't it that?
I love that. Listen, I've got to give you a chance to promote your documentary. Although, I tell you, I could talk with you for hours. I would love, I don't know if I get the commitment right here, folks. I'd love to have you on my show for a full hour.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I'd like to be there. Really would. Especially if you let me sell my movie.
I will let you sell your movie. Tell me about it.
My movie is titled Body of War. We have a website, bodyofwar.com. This is a movie that I finance, have produced, and have co-directed with
your
a wonderful filmmaker by the name of Ellen Spiro. So, I mean, you can't make a movie by yourself. I ought to know. And I got myself a fabulous camera person to bring in. Just, I couldn't believe what
and
she was bringing.
And it's the story of a wounded vet. I mean, he's the hero or
he is.
Of your story.
He signed up 9/13, wanted to get the evil Uber, saw the president on
I
the
have
pile.
Friends that did that.
And this is a bright young man. This is a young man with insight. He's a Heartland kid, Kansas City, Missouri.
What happened to him?
He's in Iraq 5 days, open top.
5 days.
Mm-hmm, open top truck going down Main Street, Sadr City, and from a rooftop, the bullet came through his shoulder blade and exited T4. That's between the shoulder blades.
It's one
and
of the
back.
Spinal cords.
He is paralyzed from the nipples down.
Wow.
Thomas can't talk. Thomas can't cough. His stomach muscles are paralyzed. Thomas has morning nausea. He throws up every morning.
How does he communicate?
He can talk. He can't walk.
Oh, he can't walk.
He has arms,
right,
and speech and head movement.
Okay.
He has nothing below the nipples. And the closer you get to him, erectile dysfunction, 27 years old, the more you're just blown back by the gravity of this injury. His urinary tract infection, because he has to be cathetered, and if the urine stays in the urethra, then it crystallizes, causes...
How does someone like him, who joined in the patriotic fervor after September 11th, and then was sent not to Afghanistan, the war that most of us felt was at least a justified war,
mm-hmm,
and sent to a country that never attacked us. And
right.
Did he not want to go? Did he believe in it at the time and become disillusioned?
He did. He believed in it
in Iraq.
But no, not in Iraq.
Oh, in Afghanistan.
When he signed up.
Right, he believed in Afghanistan.
The light bulb went on at Fort Hood during basic. He said, what am I doing here? Iraq. And
they didn't attack us.
And they had nothing to do with 9/11.
Right.
And why are we going here?
Right.
But it was a little too late. He's in now. And he goes there, and he's there 5 days, and he's going down Main Street, Sadr City. He is transferred to Landstuhl, then to Walter Reed, where I met him, and then to St. Louis Rehab, and then home. By the way, he meets Bobby Mueller in our film.
Really?
Bobby
Mueller. I just saw Bobby Mueller. In fact, he's the director of the FBI. I saw him in a hearing.
No. This is
a different
Mueller.
Oh, you're talking about a different Mueller. Yeah. Excuse me. I'm talking about the FBI director.
That's Robert Mueller.
That's Robert Mueller. I thought you were talking about
Bobby Mueller.
Who's Bobby Mueller?
Bobby Mueller is a Vietnam veteran who's been in a wheelchair for 38 years.
Oh, my God.
Having sustained the same bullet wound that Thomas had, the subject of my film.
Wow.
So Thomas rolls into Bobby Mueller's apartment. And they talk, and we film this.
Right.
And Bobby said, how long were you in the hospital, Thomas? And Thomas said, counts on his fingers, he said, over the course, about 3.5-4 months. And Bobby stares at him, and there's a long, long pause in our movie. You see this. And he looks at Thomas, he said, Thomas, I was in the hospital for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on an outpatient basis for another 9 months. You got short shrift, man. I mean, this is Bobby Mueller, who calls himself a gimp.
Yeah.
And Thomas says, not somebody else who says gimp, And you have the old gimp right. kind of instructing the new GIMP on what his life's going to be like.
Well, I saw some of these in the Doonesbury cartoons. I'll tell you, Phil, again, I'd love to talk with you for a full hour.
Right.
Your publicity person is insisting I leave,
yeah.
and I don't want to. I want to talk with you more, but tell me, your film's opening in D.C., Washington.
It's opening in D.C. on April 4th.
April 4th. Where
at the E Street Theater in D.C.
E Street Theater. All right, I know it well.
And then we go to New York, April 9th.
Okay.
Then to Boston. And we're going to San Francisco.
And eventually people, wherever they live, will be able to get it on some
DVD or
something.
You know, we're out there proving our attractability here. You know, we have to prove we can sell tickets, and we think we can. We think our movie is different.
Phil Donahue, it is such a pleasure and an honor to have you here on the Inside Scoop, and I want to have you back. All right?
I'm looking for you at the opening now.
I'll be there. I'll be there. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, if you enjoyed Phil Donahue's interview half as much as I did, then you really enjoyed that interview. There's something about the man, I have to tell you. A lot of very famous people, they get